In this session, as mentioned in your brochure, and as we mentioned before the break, we want to take a look at maintaining our own integrity. Hi, Mike. Cool. Sorry, I just love catching up with friends of mine. Sorry. Having said it, we want to take a look now in this session. Who was at the noise conference here? Cool. That was a fabulous opportunity. But I'm going to repeat some of that material. So if you want to just like black out and go to sleep, it's cool too. So, but obviously the majority of you not, I do believe you need to hear this because I want to take a look at information to encourage you in your efforts to help others so that we don't become castaway and statistics because the risks are against us. Every year, as mentioned, a lot of leadership have moral failure in their lives or they get set up for it, and we want to minimize the risks so that in our effort now to go forward and help others, we don't become entangled. It's useful to know where the pitfalls are. And having worked in this field of ministry for many years, I know of many crash and burn episodes. And I promise you, those who did crash and burn never thought it would happen to them. So we want to take a look at the characteristics that put us at risk. And we want to know what we can do about that, that we can survive a little better. And then we'll go forward into taking a look at serving others, and especially in light of sexual abuse, what we can do to intervene in all of this to the degree that we can. Newsweek magazine, famous U.S. publication, but is known in much of the world, Newsweek magazine had a cover story a few years ago. And it was the cover story of the magazine. It showed a man and a woman in bed. And it was a client and a counselor having an affair. And this was the topic of that content in that magazine about people in people-helping professions who cross the lines and get involved inappropriately. And here, in the survey, they did research. They found out in their survey, they surveyed doctors and lawyers and dentists. They surveyed therapists and counselors, psychiatrists. They also surveyed pastors. And they found in their research that 87% admitted to being sexually, romantically attracted to someone in their care. And that's no big drama. If all of them had been honest, it would have been 100%. Everybody in this room who's been married 10 minutes knows that just because you're married doesn't mean that everyone on earth is no longer available or desirable or attractive. Somehow, a lot of people, especially young people, have a mistaken sentiment that thinks, when I get married, I'll never have eyes for anybody but you. Anyway, the fact of the matter is, what the marriage vows should actually be saying in a more forthright way is, you're going to find other people desirable and attractive and available, and they're going to look at you similarly. And you know what? So what? You're making a promise before God and everybody else, so it doesn't matter how you temporarily feel about your spouse or other people. You've made a promise. That's the way it really ought to be spelled out, because that's what the vows are inferring, that you're off the shelf, not that you will never be attracted to anybody. And so 87% in this survey admitted being attracted to somebody. That's no big drama. We all have that capacity, and it's temporary. But here's the shocker. 48% admitted to going all the way. Now, that's almost like one in two. You know, one in two were saying at some point they crossed the line and got involved romantically and sexually with someone in their care. I know, it makes you kind of scared who you want to go talk to. Well, I will tell you, I've had many clients come to me and tell me how they've been hit on, sexually approached, by caregivers. So, here I am, a man with a broken life. Oh, one more stat I got to mention. And for Christian workers, pastors, the percentage of risk of moral failure is 30 percentage points higher than for secular caregivers. You want to know why? Here's my two reasons of suspicion. Because, first of all, church culture is so spectacularly ignorant about what sets us up and makes us vulnerable, first of all. And then we don't know what to do about it when it does befall us. And secondly, Satan would make us bigger targets. Because when we fail, the name of Christ is diminished and the flock is injured. Would you agree with that idea? So the risks are there. Research has already gone before, and this is not limited. There's a lot of research on this. In fact, a book that you might want to consider, I cannot recall the names of the authors because they are multiple syllable authors' last names, but the name of the book is, I've got it on a list I'm going to give you. I will remember. It's a long, long title too, but it's about inappropriate activity in the counseling office. And so here I am, a pastoral worker, people coming into my office, not to deal with financial management counseling, like I said, but they want to deal with issues related to sexuality. I am not a professional therapist under strict supervision, as would be the ethical situation for a professional. Most of us in pastoral care are a little more freewheeling, and that also works against us. That's probably why the percentage point is also higher. We are less supervised according to professional standards that the counseling industry otherwise is. Therefore, what have I done to survive my own inner world of vulnerability and in service to people who may come to me with very mixed motivations? So here's what I do. That's me. And that's my desk or table. And when somebody comes into my office to talk with me, let me ask you the question. Whoever told you that counseling has to be one person talking to one other person? Who made the rule? Did God? Is it in the Bible? Do we have to do it this way? Why should we do it this way with sexual relationship counseling when you consider that most moral failures that do occur on a one-on-one ratio? Remember, nurses on the general ward have a different approach than nurses in the infectious disease ward. And in the infectious disease ward, you got to ratchet it up another notch or two to guard yourself from the heightened risk. Agreed? So I'm at heightened risk. I am a broken, wounded healer and vulnerable. I can resonate with the issues brought into the office. I got to be careful. And likewise, clients come in. And you know what? I've learned about sexual strugglers. If you're warm, if you're caring, and if you're available, they may only know how to interpret that as sexual. You may not mean it. You would not send that signal. They may not know how to interpret correctly. And this usually proves to be very, very temporary, but they have to wade through it. And so we don't want to send that signal, do we? We want to make it very clear that the last thing that we are going to have to reckon with here is some sexual thing going on under the surface, right? But yet it's a real concern. And so here's what I do to diminish my risks. Here's my client. And this is the client. I say client rather than counselee because I like the idea that this, I don't know, it's just my hang up, but I feel like counselee and counselor, it does assign roles, but it infers that I have all the goods and they don't have anything. Client is an informed person who's come for a service. And with this in mind, though, I have a desk between me and the client. Do you want to know why? Because 80% of my clients have histories of boundary violation before the age of 12. This means that they have a history, generally, that brings them into my office that they're trying to reckon with, and that history generally means they have had boundary violations as a way of relating to people. Either emotionally, they are over-attached and dependent, or they are people who have been sexually boundaryless. And if not sexually boundaryless because of being victimized, they may be people who are scared to death. They might be. But yet it's all related to the issue of boundary violation. You with me? So what does my desk do? What does my table do? It says there is a boundary between you and I, and we will not get too close too quickly, so you can relax. And I don't even have to say it. Okay? And what that means then is if I want to reach across the table and take your hand and hold it in prayer, I can ask your permission. And if you're not comfortable, you can say so. No big deal. Thanks for letting me know. I'm going to pray for you anyway. And then if they say, no, it's okay, you can hold my hand, we can still have contact, but it's not going to get too close too quick. They can relax. Unconsciously, it's amazing how that works. Then I have one more feature in here. I usually have a window. Here's the door into the room, and there's a window, And they can't see as people walk by. They may not be able to see the client, but they can see me. Okay? But here's the real key feature I want to mention. Right over here is a third counselor. The reason why I have bothered to have another counselor with me is, there are many, many benefits to this. What happens if a client misinterprets my warmth and care as sexual? It's not going to go anywhere. They're not going to play some game because there's a witness. And add to it, what if they have come in with a wrongful motivation? Because there are some clients who deliberately go looking to seduce. Now, this is rare, but it does occur. And if you counsel enough people, you will encounter it. And they've got some maybe not even recognized agenda where they're out to pull down leadership and there's anger. And so they're looking for an opportunity. Let us not give them one. Let us cover ourselves, correct? Likewise, what if my client is scared to death that I might try to make a move on them? What if they've come in good hope and in good faith, but what if they've been approached before by someone in the counseling arena? And so the last thing I want them to worry about, that this is going to be a dynamic to deal with. And so having another witness there means I don't have to fret with that either. You begin to see how it clears a path for a healthier connection. And why should I expect them to connect healthily with me on one-on-one when they've never connected healthily with anybody one-on-one? What magic do I think my office possesses that somehow it's going to be better than that? Okay? Whereas two people are not a family, but three people begin to be one. And it's the kind of nucleus of a cell group concept also. Okay? Because people don't get wounded in isolation. They usually get wounded in community. In a peer group, in a family setting, we want to create a new kind that is nurturant rather than abusive, obviously. And then, of course, what if the client gets mad at me in their immaturity? I have to challenge them about something, and they get all indignant, and they walk out, and they want to spread a bad report. You know what? It's not going to go anywhere. I've got a witness. I'm from America, land of litigation. You better believe we know how to cover our butts. And so, with this in mind, more positively and less dramatically, I'm multiplying ministry. I'm apprenticing. And if I'm on a trip, and when I don't do pastoral counseling now, I do teaching exclusively, but during my 15, 17 years of doing this, I would travel 20% of my year. What would happen if I was on a trip and a crisis would emerge? We now don't have to reinvent the wheel. We've got an informed person who can immediately step into the mix. You see the advantages? Now, why would you ever go back to one-on-one counseling for sexual concerns? Now, you might say, well, you know, if that person, you know, like some people have wondered, well, what if people won't open up if there's another person there? I find quite the opposite. People with all this relaxing going on, feeling safer and covered and boundaried, they open up much more. And in fact, in my 15 years of employing this approach, I have had like maybe one or two times somebody say to me, well, I'm not going to come if there's another counselor there. I'm not going to open up if another person's in that room. And you know what I have to say to them? See ya. Because my job is to protect my interests also. It's not just about your ego and what makes you feel comfortable. I offer you a service. It is under these terms. If you do not like it, I understand. You can go elsewhere. But I'm going to make myself available this way. Okay? And you know what? It may sound harsh, but rarely have I ever had to say it. Because most people don't have a problem. Now, a question I do get asked is, if you're dealing with a female client, what about, should this be male or female as the co-counselor? Almost always, I would strive to have another female counselor. Many of these women, they have been victimized by men. To having two guys in there, even if they're wonderful, safe guys, can be a bit heavy-handed, even if unconsciously. We don't want to have to wade through that. So I will say that when we have a male client, sometimes we will have a female, but we will always ask. And many times males will say, no, I would really prefer another male. So we'll have to shop and get one. But, you know, it's worth making that effort. Because some guys don't want to open up in front of women and say some of these things. It becomes a stumbling block, and that's not going to make the dynamic work, right? So we want to make the flow happen. So does that make sense? Is there a question about this approach? Do you see its many advantages? Pardon? Well, no. You have to split and wrestle and fight over those coins. But you could always work out some arrangement, perhaps. Again, we're in the first world, and it's true that not all of us are rich, but we mustn't compare ourselves to the Beverly Hills crew. We are fabulously wealthy compared to most of the rest of humanity on the planet, that we are even afforded the luxury of dealing with unhappy childhood issues not quite yet resolved, where most of the rest of the world is just trying to eat. So the fact that we require some people to invest in getting better, we would expect that in any other service that we offer. This is not the gospel. This is a service to help people get derailed lives back on track, or to help people find clarity where there is confusion. Okay? And so there's nothing wrong if they invest, even if it's not a lot. I think people can spend money on porn. People can spend money on cigarettes and booze. People can spend money on hideaways to commit adultery. People can spend money on getting back on track. Okay? They take it more seriously. It gives value to it. And don't let anybody tell you differently. You don't have to agree with me, but I still got the mic. So, again, it doesn't have to be a lot of money. But we still want people to make an investment in their getting better. They take it seriously. Okay? It's not trying to be cruel. And we work out a deal. If somebody can't afford much, if they can't afford $50 an hour, you think that sounds like a lot? In North America, the average one-hour session begins at $90 to $120 U.S. dollars for Christian therapy. Now, I'm not offering therapy because I'm not a therapist, but I am a pastoral worker offering a service, at least in the times that we offered this. So while I had a salary, we did want people to still invest in their getting better, because they take it more seriously, as you know you do when you pay for something. So that's why we would consider that. You can think about that. Question related to this before we go on to the real point that I want to talk about, because this isn't it. Thank you. Very good. Especially when apprenticing a younger co-counselor. I'm sorry, the question was, with regard to this other co-counselor, kind of like, what's their level of participation? What role do they play? Obviously, in the beginning, wonderful options are like Bible college students or students of counseling, people going to university who might look for an apprenticeship, internship opportunity is something you might consider. But, you know, you want to do a background check on them and kind of know what's going on with them, obviously. But the point is, in the beginning, they've never waded into these waters, and so we're going to want to give them opportunity to observe first. So we might even give them that observation time. You don't feel a need to contribute. And then when you feel there is something you'd like to say, talk to me after the session about it, and then we can always bring it to the table the next time we reconvene. So, you know, where they're not feeling some pressure to have to come up with an answer. And then for those who might be a little bit more verbose, you can imagine how we would then arm wrestle over oxygen in the room. The fact of the matter is, though we would want them to understand the need to listen. And what's the goal of counseling? Is it to give solutions to people? No. It's to help people find clarity. Generally, answers are already forthcoming in people, but they're not clarified yet. And so, you know, I'm not a professional therapist to do psychotherapy on people. So I don't need to pretend that I am one. But what's really cool about having this co-counselor is they become more comfortable in the relationship with the client and in relating to me and the whole dynamic, is that then they begin to feel more confident to respond. And, you know, there's where it's useful that we can evaluate them and say, you know what? You might want to come up with code words that mean like, you're over-talking, without having to hurt their ego, you know? If I wanted the opinion, I'd say, so what do you think about this? So giving them opportunity to participate. And then it's just a matter of growing in course. But I think it is useful to spell out your expectations and be clarified about what I'm wanting from the co-counselor so that they can walk in there and be a little more confident. That, you know, for the next three sessions, you don't have to say anything and we can talk afterward. And also you want them to sign a confidentiality contract that they're not going to talk about this outside, except under the stated circumstances under which, and then they wouldn't be the ones to blow the whistle, I would be the one. Okay? So is that kind of clearer? So you don't have to be a professional therapist to be a little bit better and more effective in what we do, and you just kind of think through some of these things. And the reason why I've come up with this model is because I saw the glaring evidence of not having this model. So you think, oh, it's expensive to do this, or oh, it's really time-consuming, or oh, what an extra effort. It's a much bigger cost and effort if you don't. Because we're dealing with the sex stuff, not just any old issue. It's not Old Testament theology here, it's sex stuff. So, and I do even put parameters on clients and what I allow them to say. Now, sometimes they need to say things, or they blurt something out, that's not a big drama. But generally, we let them know, I don't need to know dirty details. I might want to ask clarification. If they say, I've had a moral failure, I might want to know, are you talking about in your head or with masturbation, or are you talking about actual sexual contact with another person? That kind of clarification is useful, but I don't need to know lots of gore. And then even after listening, even under these safe circumstances, we need to pray for each other when it's over and decontaminate, because we may have been slimed. And there may be demonic infection here also. You know, you've got to think about that kind of stuff. You're messing in the messy. And so you want to make sure you decontaminate, submit these things to Jesus and wash off. And then if you find that it's hooked in your head and you're coming back around to it again and again, you want to take another step of action and deal with this even more deliberately so that you don't get infected. Okay? Another question? Did you find that useful? It's a nice little model to put to work to keep you safer, not completely free, but safer in a world of risk that sexual-related counseling can impose. Okay? Now, moral failures and spiritual burnout go hand in hand. Would you agree that there's probably not going to be a moral failure among a spiritually healthy person? So moral failures and spiritual burnout tend to go hand in hand. And I want to share with you information that my wonderful pastor in America many years ago, David Lovelace, shared with me that I have proven over time and applied and have proven it true in my own life and ministry. That's why it's wonderful to get to turn that around and share it with you, because it worked for me. Moral failure and spiritual burnout they have three basic characteristics we must all ever have present in our thinking. Number one, they are gradual. You don't see it coming. The water just gets deeper. And then you're swept away. Gradual. They occur over time. The headline-making disaster scandal was usually years in the making. For example, I love to talk about airplanes. I have to fly for a living. I fly every week. I flew last year just in foreign travel 140,000 miles. So when you travel a lot, you have some interesting experiences. As has been said of air travel, it's hours of stupefying boredom punctuated by moments of sheer terror. And so I've been in aborted takeoffs and aborted landings. I've been in two pretty dramatic emergency landings. One of them made the national news, had injured passengers. So, you know, anyway, in fact, I'm wearing my flight attendant uniform today. In fact, I can't convince people I'm not cabin crew if I'm not careful about how I dress. In fact, one day I was on this flight going to Atlanta, and this woman was convinced I was cabin crew, so I just stopped arguing. I took her to her seat, and I put her bag up in the bin. And when she learned I wasn't cabin crew, she said, I knew it was too good to be true. And I said, you're right. When has a cabin crew ever helped you put your bag up in the bin or take you to your seat? So, especially in the United States Air Traffic Service. So anyway, the fact is, I learned a lot of lessons in the realm of aerodynamics, and here's one of them. Maybe you remember just up the road in the Hawaiian Island chain, about a decade ago, there was a 737 flying on an inter-island shuttle hop. And it had reached altitude at 22,000 feet, and suddenly, in the middle of space, that plane blew off a third of its fuselage from behind the cockpit. And it left a third of that cabin, passengers strapped in their seats with no ceiling and no floor, and no wall and window, just the Pacific Ocean meters below. Only one person, miraculously, only one person died, a Christian woman who was a flight attendant who had just unbuckled her belt to begin cabin service. And miraculously, they landed the plane to make an interesting story to tell grandchildren. But the point is, if you remember that day, and here I was just getting ready to board a plane in St. Louis when that happened, and I gave them my ticket and walked on board. So So anyway, what did they learn about this flight? Here's what they learned. That the aircraft cabin, because it flew over the very salty Pacific, the plane suffered a particular malady. I'll elaborate in a moment, but have you noticed that planes are built to handle stress? They pull away from the building and they rumble down the runway, and every you hear it, the creaking and the joints and the flexing, and you wonder. And then it breaks gravity because Bernoulli's principle of aerodynamic lift takes over. What that means is, if you're not familiar, the surface of the wing is curved. The bottom of the wing is flat. Engines don't make the plane go up. They make it go forward like a rocket. But what happens is, the way the wing is shaped, the air here must move faster to get over the curved surface. Here, it's more straightforward. And this creates a little bubble of low pressure on the surface of the wing. And that's what makes all that metal go up. A little invisible bubble of low pressure. Anyway. So the plane takes off and it begins to overcome gravity of 1 million pounds, 747, flying. And so tremendous pressures and forces are exerted on the aircraft. And it creaks and it groans and shudders. And then finally, lift is accomplished. The plane is flying. And then it goes through dramatic pressure changes. And the skin of the plane will buckle and expand and contract. And then the temperature outside will drop something like 100 degrees Celsius below freezing. And then you go through turbulence and the wings will flex and you'll think, oh my God. And then the plane begins to descend. And of course, as pilots will say, landing is basically an orchestrated plunge to Earth. And in fact, that's why 48% of all accidents occur in the landing sequence. You can thank me later. And what happens is, as the flaps are extended, as the flaps are extended this way, it begins to break up this airflow and the plane begins to sink. And it does so, and it goes through temperature changes and air pressure changes again, and then it makes contact with the earth, bam! And then it rumbles up to the building and it unloads the passengers, offloads them, unloads more, and it does it day in and day out for over 30 years safely. Because planes are built to handle stress. It's routine to their working environment and working life. And you know what? Nothing wrong with that stress. Aircraft manufacturers build the plane capable for all of that and much more than they ever go through, generally speaking. But however, stress must be maintained, because stress left unchecked over time produces disaster. And this is what happened with that jet in the Hawaiian Islands. Little tiny hairline cracks began to be created due to stress. No big drama. Every so many thousands of miles, they take an x-ray of the airplane to make sure those stresses don't add up. But here, that plane had not been maintained in that way for 22 years of flying service. And so the little cracks added up. You couldn't see them, but they were real. And so one day, what happened was, the normal stresses and pressures it should have been built to withstand, if maintenanced, well, there was one last little crack on that eroded camel's back, and one third of the skin blew off the plane. It was 22 years in the making. Here's the formula one more time. Stress over time left unmaintenanced equals disaster. Now, think about your life as a Christian worker particularly. You were built by God as a human to handle stress. Would you agree? Financial stress, raising children stress, dealing with your inner world stress, handling traffic stress, all of it are stresses, and they are real stresses, and they weigh upon us, but we're built by God to accommodate a lot of stress in life, but not left unmaintenanced. The average Christian worker lasts 7 years before burnout. It's not because the need's so great or the burden's too heavy, it's because our lives are poorly managed. We treat our car engines better than our inner world many times. We just keep on clicking along thinking that's our obligation, and then finally we are overwhelmed and we collapse. Does that sound familiar? For your friend? Not you, of course, but listen for them. And stress over time left unmaintenanced equals the disaster that was years in the making. King David did not commit adultery overnight. He was a young shepherd boy with a clear, uncluttered view of God. He was a prince under pressure who demonstrated remarkable integrity when stressed. It was when he became rich and famous, fat and happy, and had everybody do the hard work for him, and he had life revolving around him as a celebrity in the kingdom, it was then that he had his moral collapse. Because his integrity got eroded slowly. You know the law of entropy? E-N-T-R-O-P-Y. Entropy proves you're in trouble. Entropy is the second law of thermodynamics, and it says this: all energy will decay. So if you have a stove, flame turned on, tea kettle on it, and the water begins to boil, just because it's hot now doesn't mean it'll stay hot. You turn off the fire, the energy will decay, and the water will reduce down to room temperature. It's true in marriage. If you don't maintain commitment and communication, what started hot will grow cold and drift apart. And the same is true in relationship with God and maintaining integrity in a world where the law of sin and death says your relationships and your integrity are eroded continually. You shore it up or it washes away. Does that make sense? Okay. Stress over time, left unchecked, gets you into trouble. And that's why we need to make sure we get checkups. Did you know I see a therapist at least twice a year? You know why? To make sure that I don't have a blowout, so that somebody who knows how to read me and read me better than I might care to read myself, and someone who will tell me the truth I need to hear and who will reflect back to me and minister to me, I go to see a therapist, not because I'm having a problem, but to preempt a problem. It's just changing the oil before the engine burns out. And why do we think that we don't need to do that? When I've learned not doing it sets you up for trouble. Doing it helps to save you from it. A stitch in time does save nine. You know what I mean? And how many Christians think, oh no, I'm the healthy one and I'm the mature one and I'm the one that's above and beyond this and don't need it. Yeah, well, that may be a first step toward disaster. I've seen other people think that way, and that's why I've been seeing a therapist now since about 1994, about twice a year, just to make sure that I keep my inner world balanced. Add to it, I need more reflection. I need more maintenance than that. My life is stressful. And so I also take 2 months off a year. I also have to deal with my inner world and take a break because I live a demanding lifestyle. Add to that, I have a pastoral staff around me. My pastor, I have to report to him every quarter. And he and an elder, they minister to me. They don't ask me if I'm having issues. They assume I will be because my life is stressful. Just like mechanics understand on a car or an airplane that if you drive it enough, it's going to need some attention. We don't assume it might. We don't look for it. We just assume it's going to need the maintenance, and we do it preemptively. Does that make sense? That's the tack I take. Prevention is better than cure. Okay? Third characteristic of moral failure. So you're going to get two sermons in this. You're going to get airplane safety. Oh, I don't know. When it comes to all this scary stuff in air travel, I figure why not share the fear? So, moral failures are gradual. Think of this gradual. I got to tell you this story. It's so cool. I was in Victoria, you know, in Australia, state of Victoria. And if you know their wonderful 12 Apostles coastline there, this happened just a few years ago. There was this one particular formation out there, and there was an archway, and the water passed through this. And a lot of tourists would come out here and enjoy it and take their picture there. Well, one day, one final little wave lapped up and licked the bottom of that arch, and the arch collapsed in dramatic fashion. Fortunately, everybody survived, but they were all trapped on what was now a little point, separated from the mainland. The point is, since Noah's floodwaters withdrew, it had taken that many years for that collapse to have occurred. And it was kind of cool. God had some witnesses there to observe it. But my point is, wave after wave, lapping and eroding and corroding, it took years for the spectacular disaster to occur. And so, gradual. Got to be careful. Have others reflect back to you what you may not see. What does Oswald Chambers say? Thinking you know yourself so well is always the last conceit to go. Anyway, the next thing, they're not only gradual, they're complex. There's never just one thing that makes you have a moral failure. It's not just that you've got a sexual nature, and it's not just that you've got hormones. It's not just that you're a human being vulnerable and weak with a fallen nature, it's not just that we live in a Pied Piper of culture and its values rubbed in our face, and it's not just that there's a devil to exploit you. It's all of it working together. It's complex. You know, airplanes don't crash for just one reason. I was thinking of this jetliner, brand new aircraft, landing in the great Dallas-Fort Worth airport. Dallas-Fort Worth is a major metropolitan area of about 6 million in the United States, a very important trade center with one of America's largest, most modern airports. Pilots love it because it's so safe. And so the planes were on approach. And you know, when a plane's going low and slow, it's preparing to land, but it's at its most vulnerable. There's very little room for a boo-boo to be accommodated. And so this jet had taken off from Florida on America's East Coast and was going to Los Angeles, but it was making a stopover in Dallas to offload and unload passengers. And so the jet was on its approach, and it was a fabulous piece of technology, an L-1011, preferred by pilots in that day, because it was such an aerodynamically safe, sound aircraft. And the pilot was getting ready to retire in only 3 years after a spectacularly safe career. He did not want to die, but he did. And so the plane was coming down, going low and slow, but the one thing, it's not going low and slow that caused them to crash. Low and slow, planes have to go when they land. But that made them vulnerable. But then there was the unexpected factor added to the complex mix, and it was a little rain shower that had rained on the plane before them that had now turned into a supercell with downdraft that caused that plane to lose lift when it couldn't afford to recover it, and that plane crashed just a kilometer short of the runway, killing everybody but 18 passengers on board. In fact, the only flight attendant who walked away uninjured was a Christian flight attendant whose husband had beeped the horn as she went back to work after her honeymoon, saying, "I'll be praying for you." So anyway, this crash tells us this lesson. Going low and slow doesn't make you crash, it makes you vulnerable. But when you have lost altitude and you are slowed down, what unexpected factor may come along to push you the rest of the way? Look at King David, in the wrong place, at the wrong time. That did not make him commit adultery. That was just going low and slow. But then the unexpected factor misses naked Bathsheba on the rooftop. That's what pushed him, bink, over the edge. He was already low and slow. His integrity was already eroded and corroded. But the unexpected factor that he saw because he was in the wrong place at the wrong time pushed him over into disaster. You follow that idea? Satan can't make you do it overnight. He sets you up to get you low and slow. You following that? Okay. They're complex. And finally, they play off your unmet needs. Moral failures and spiritual burnout play off your unmet needs. What are your unmet needs? Let me tell you, here's what I've learned. Here's what my pastor taught me as the formula for disaster. This is how you go low and slow. Here are unmet needs. You work too much. You play too little. You love too seldom. That is the recipe for disaster. You know, Satan, when he tries to wreck our lives, he doesn't usually come up to a pastor and say, "You see that gorgeous babe? Throw your ministry, your family, and your reputation down the drain. Commit adultery." He doesn't do that, does he? He's much more clever than that. He knows that if we have an unmet need, for example, who among us is not somewhat insecure? Who among us doesn't at times doubt their value? Who among us doesn't want to feel like what we do makes us significant and makes a contribution to God's work? We all have an ego that needs to be stroked, and that's not bad, that's human. It's when we think we aren't valuable that we feel a need to prove something. It's when we think that we need to be viewed as significant that we might work to do whatever it takes to get that stroke. And there's where Satan gets us doing really good things that take us away from the best thing. Are you with that? He can get us to run a very good race, but miss the real race that matters. Ecclesiastes said it very knowingly centuries ago. Oh, yes, you can see a man accomplish an awful lot in his life out of his envy of his neighbor. That's insecurity. Getting you to get your ego stroked by keeping up with some Joneses to prove that you too are also valuable and significant. It's the great Achilles heel for most of us in ministry. And so, does it make us bad? It makes us vulnerable. And so here's how it works. If you grew up feeling insignificant and now people affirm what you do, then maybe the bread of life isn't Jesus so much, but there's a subtle shift where the bread becomes what we do. This is where I get my strokes, and I need to get me more of those strokes. And so I got to get me more and more of those strokes. So that means I got to be working more and more to keep earning those strokes. And then you begin to work too much and you miss out on your true purpose, because your value isn't what you do, it's who you belong to. And then, of course, what happens when you work too much? Things get out of balance and you get too little rest. We talked about the Sabbath issue earlier. How many Christian workers? They work till they burn out. They don't manage well. And then what happens? You work too much, you play too little, and you start making poor decisions. Your immune system gets compromised, brain chemistry begins to get unbalanced, you don't handle stresses as well, and then you are spending so much time at work, you begin bonding with people apart from home and covenant, because you bond naturally with people you spend more time with. It's an inescapable fact of the human nature. That's why if you spend time away in some high-rise from your family, you must go home and compensate. Because if you don't, you will bond, and that's why office affairs occur, even with the pastor and the secretary. Okay? And then, your love too seldom makes you hungry. So here, you're off trying to satisfy ego needs by working too much, your life is out of balance, and then you're tired, and you don't get rest and recreation, so you handle stress wrongly, and then your heart, you know, your love tank gets low, and so you become hungry, and hungry people begin to look for anything for satisfaction and comfort. And thus, it may take 20 years before the disaster turns into a scandal. Does that make sense? Okay. They play off our unmet needs. Now, most of us probably find ourselves in here somewhere. I am not being critical. I have been one of these people. And I also work hard. But here's how my pastor taught me to do it a little better. So let me share with you survival strategies as we head into this part of our session. You finding this useful? For your friend? I know. If only they were here. Listen for them. Let's just look at this very pragmatically. What happens if you work too much? What are you going to do? Well, I don't know. We paid you to tell us. Okay, I will. I'll tell you what I do. I try to work smarter. And I try to work in boundaries better. I don't know about you, but as a people helper, people helpers have a hard time saying no. And sometimes that's because we really care about people, and sometimes it's because we think we have to always say yes. And sometimes it's a mingling of both of those ideas. But you know, I'm in the people helping business because I care to help people, obviously. And that gets me up in the morning. There are different ways to help people. One of them is teaching. That's what thrills me today. But it used to be pastoral care for many years. And so I have a hard time saying no. And I would go home from work and work would follow me home and people would call and the telephone soon became the helephone. You know what I mean. And so I had a wonderful board and they began to help me reorient my life and give me boundaries I would not have thought I had permission to give myself. Because I grew up with a Christian mentality that I am everybody else's servant and slave, including God's and everybody else who has a need. And if the doorbell rings or the phone rings, I am to be available to anybody, everybody, all the time, anytime, anybody ever asks. Does that sound familiar? I don't think somebody sat me down and told me that. It's the flavor that somehow got developed in my thinking. And so, all work and no play makes Jack a very bitter and twisted Christian worker. So, my board began to help me recalibrate my life. And they would say, you know, Si, you got to learn to work smarter. There's a time to serve and be available and a time not to. And they began to paint the picture to me of the life of Jesus. Now, Jesus, often people aren't clear on this distinction. And so, let me spell it out, what really was a revelation to me. Sometimes Jesus would be out there at his own sacrifice serving the masses. Yes, And they would clamor and press upon him, and he would undoubtedly be physically drained, but he would serve them, and he would give to them, and he would minister to them. And yet, there were times when Jesus would walk away from them and leave them crying out, "Help me, Lord," and he would physically get up and move away from them. Yes? Point is, Jesus did not come to earth to meet everybody's needs whenever they asked. He came to do the will of the Father. And therein is the distinction lost on well-intentioned people who work too much. Jesus at times served and gave, sacrificed. And then there were times he walked away because the will of the Father said, "Leave them, come be with me. Walk away from them, hang out with your disciples." Jesus was a human being. And so to me, when I got that revelation, I realized, you're right, there is a time that I'm to serve people. And then there's a time I got to get my own tank filled up, let alone I'm not in covenant with my clients. I am in covenant with my family. And I shouldn't be leaving them with the little leftover dribble. I hope they're happy with it because I've given the best of myself to everybody else. I need to apportion a time for them or they will be left with nothing and then they'll be bitter and twisted at me and God. Isn't that the legacy we hear in so many situations? And so I had to realize there was a time for me to give to my clients, and that's when I'm at the office. And then when I am away from the office, I turn off the telephone. I don't hope it doesn't ring. I make myself unavailable. A guru for corporate leadership, she said one time to me, when I say guru, I mean a consultant to corporate management. She gives them great advice. And she said to me something I've never forgotten. Through modern technology, too many people have too much casual access to us all the time. And so we don't hope nobody ever rings. We take control and put a boundary in place that says, I'm not available right now. Now, a lot of us live hooked on the phone like, but what if Aunt Stella dies? You know, well, most of us are not waiting for someone to die continually, daily, with the way that we wait for the phone to ring, if you follow my thinking. And so it's true if you turn the phone off, there might be a situation you miss. But more often than not, there's situations you get to contribute to because you put a boundary in place. Because I've learned from clients who are needy, they will not care about my needs. They will only be thinking of theirs. This doesn't make them bad. It means they're self-absorbed, and we understand when people are in pain and having problems. But I have a family. And so I got to set a time for them and for myself and not hope nobody calls. And I learned this lesson the hard way. I gave out my phone number one time mistakenly to an emotionally dependent client. In a fit of compassion, I gave him my number. My board had told me not to do this. And so I, shall we say, rued the day. And what happened was he began to call me every night at about 11 p.m. And this would go sometimes till 1 a.m., like almost every night. And at first, maybe he was in crisis. And what's the Bible say? You know, I'm to bear the burdens of the weak, and I'm to go the extra mile, and I'm to consider my neighbor and treat my neighbor like I'd like. I understood that, and I did that. But you know what? After a while, his little crisis became mine. And so one night, smoke coming out my nose, I rolled over in bed. My wife looked at me, and she said, I don't know why you're so offended with him, Si. You're expecting him to get where your limits are, and he obviously doesn't. He's only thinking about his own needs and doesn't understand where your limits are, and he never will if you don't show him. It's like a revelation. She and God, they're always right, and she was. And so, you know, I said, okay. And so I realized what I needed to do as a brother's keeper. The next night, predictably, he called. And I said, you know, I take responsibility for letting a bad habit get started because I think that's what this is. And I think you know I care about you, but you know, it's not that crisis anymore. And I'd really like it if maybe instead of calling every night so late, you might call in the day. We'll go have a cup of coffee or something in the day. And you know, I said, I'd really appreciate it though that you not call here so late at night anymore, really. It's not a situation that warrants that. Silence at the other end of the line. And finally he said, I thought you cared. And I said, I do care. I care to get some sleep. Then he said, what kind of a Christian are you? And I said, oh, I don't know, a tired, limited, irritable human one. Because, you know, the Bible does say I'm to go the extra mile, but it says you in Proverbs, you cross my doorway too many times, you wear out your welcome and become like a curse. It doesn't say, oh, you who have needs are exempt from that. Because we're not three-year-olds, we all have to learn the mutuality of living in appropriate boundarying in relationship, or we begin to alienate people from us. True? And I would have been cruel to politely put up with that and be angry and stuff it. At the same time, rejecting him was not the answer. He'd just go repeat that pattern somewhere else. And at the same time, if I am going to be a brother's keeper, sometimes a rebuke is better than just tolerating. And so I needed to find out where the line needed to be drawn. This does not warrant you calling me every night like this, okay? And so instead of me rejecting him, I needed to draw a boundary so he could recalibrate the way that he relates and expects from me. And you know what? It was kind of embarrassing, and it was scary for me too, because I'm not used to confrontation and I don't like it. It's much easier for me to appease people, but it was better that I teach him the better way, and it was better for me too. Does that make sense? Okay. So I had to learn to begin working smarter, more strategically and in boundaries, understanding there is a time I give and serve, and then a time I get my own serving. Okay? And I don't let clients determine how I'm available. I'm available during these times for these services, and that is all. That's the best I can do. I'm a limited, frail human being. Okay? And then, play too little means get enough rest and recreation. I try to always have my Sabbath. It doesn't always have to be on a Sunday. And with my bizarre traveling lifestyle, I've had to learn to be innovative. But the fact of the matter is, I do need my rest and recreation, which is why I take 2 months off a year. And I am self-employed, and so when I'm not working, I'm not making any money. And you know what? So what? How do you pay for your mental and physical health? So I take off, you know, some break during the mid-year, during what would be Northern Hemisphere summer. Take off Christmas time. I take a month off in December. And, of course, you know, as I was saying the other day, birth of baby Jesus, nobody wants to talk about sexual sin, so it's kind of a built-in opportunity for me. And so the fact of the matter is, I take 2 months off a year, and even when I get home from this trip, for example, I'll have a week off duty. And when I say off duty, I slob out. I don't do other things like write a book or manage a ministry or counsel other people. I have nothing else to do but be with God and my family. That's it. So I really have to build in these opportunities, because if I don't build them in, they will evaporate in the routine drumbeat of life. Would you agree? So I've had to learn to look at my calendar and build in my break times. Not just the 2 months, but even in between some trips that I can catch my breath. Because I'll tell you what, I've learned what it's like to wear a blister in my soul. If you ever had the fit not right, you've worn a blister on your foot, after a while the blister rubs raw, and what was once just normal walking that you could easily do becomes intolerably painful, and you have to stop it down and let the boo-boo heal. Yep. Well, I find that you can rub a blister in your soul, and you know that you've rubbed that blister when you begin to resent the very people that you are called to serve. When you begin to go to work wishing you were already done, you've rubbed a blister. Something has to change. The calendar, the schedule, the clock has got to be recalibrated some way. And when you begin to resent the ministry God has called you to serve, when you used to love to thrive in it, then that's a crisis that tells us change is pending. You'll volunteer it, or it'll volunteer you. When that resentment is a big red flag, it says something's got to give. That's my first major signal. There are other signals, but when you get to the rub the blister in my heart part, it means you got to change. Does that make sense? Okay. And loving too seldom part, I deliberately make time for my family. I still date my wife and I still date my daughter, and it's not always cheap and easy. I brought my wife to Honolulu a week and a half ago, and it wasn't cheap, but it was really worth the investment. So I have to find ways that I can deliberately stay connected to my family in an unusual way of life. And of course, for years, my family traveled with me, and it was cool. My wife grew up in a military family where she moved every 3 years, so traveling was not a new idea to her, nor living in different parts of the world. Additionally, my wife, being an educator, a teacher by profession, was able to homeschool our daughter as we flew around the world. By the time my kid was 5, she had been to 5 continents. And so while it wasn't easy or cheap to bring my family with me, you know what? It was a lot less costly to leave them behind. Because now I've got an adult daughter who doesn't resent me in the ministry, because it didn't really take me away from her. I took her along with me. So I've had to learn to deliberately love, knowing the kind of thing that I do and hearing from clients who come to me bitter and twisted in Christian families where they felt neglected when everybody else got attention. I know I'm not a perfect father. I make my regrettable mistakes, even knowing this stuff. But at least I can do it a little bit more deliberately because I don't want to be one of those that contributes to the problem. Okay? So no condemnation, but it is useful to recognize and take action. And this is what I've learned to do a little better. So here's some survival strategies and then your questions. Let me ask you, when are you the most likely to compromise? People do things pretty predictably around the world. They're pretty much the same human beings, interesting breed. And humans, they tend to act badly. Whether you're a 2-year-old or a 40-year-old, it's usually what I call tail. Let me tell you when I act badly, when I'm likely to overindulge, likely to excuse myself, likely to over-medicate or fantasize and stuff. Let me tell you what tail means. Got a 2-year-old, you'll recognize it. Tired. Angry. What did I put here? I want to make sure I get it right. Yeah. Especially for Christian workers. Insecure. Lonely. That's when I'm the most likely to compromise God's standards in my life. When I'm tired, I don't think clearly. When I'm angry, I might react wrongly and manage stress and relationship regrettably. When I'm feeling insecure, ooh, I can be so easily manipulated and self-indulgent. And when I'm lonely, the same is true. Does that sound familiar for your friend? So remember the tail formula: tired, angry, insecure, lonely. When you're doing something you know you shouldn't, when you're going low and slow, you need to ask, what am I feeling and what's wrong? So it's very useful to know, when am I the most likely to compromise? Knowing your weaknesses are very important. And if you don't know what your weaknesses are, ask around. I'm sure people can give you feedback. Others often see so much more objectively what we have not yet realized, if you dare. Second survival strategy, developing a monitored life. What did Billy Graham say? Accountability is the price of having influence in other people's lives. Accountability. I have layers of accountability. Some of it I don't even ask for. Now, you've heard of hierarchical accountability. That means you answer to your boss. You answer to God, who watches all the good and evil that we do. We also have relational accountability. Members of my cell group love me enough to ask me the hard questions. I have my pastor and my elders who are not afraid to haul me in every quarter and slap me around till I confess. I am teasing a little. And my elders love me enough that they are not impressed with my gifting. They value it and they value the calling on my life. But because they love me and not just what I do, they're not afraid to also give me that checkup and reflect some truth back to me if I need it. So I have God. I have my pastors and elders. I have my advisors. I have colleagues and staff. I have my wife. I love my wife. Nice, quiet, demure woman that she is. I don't call her the wall for nothing. She is not afraid to give me a piece of God's mind. And she does it. She's been the most wonderful helpmate. She does it because she absolutely loves me. Only God knows me better than Karen, my wife. And she's been a tremendous helpmate and partner in the unique life that we have to live. And she's been a brilliant accountability partner. And I can go to her and I can say, you know, honey, I'm really struggling with my thought life today. Would you pray for me? How many husbands are scared to death to ever say that much to their own spouses? They're some so afraid that that'll be a sign of weakness. Or they're so afraid that the wife will be thrown off into some spin out of insecurity. When I find this about women, like a shark in the water, they may not see the body, but they can smell blood when it's there, and they'll find their way to whatever that issue is. And so, husbands, better that you volunteer it than have to be volunteered later, because they will always find it out. Because you know why they will find it out? Because God is a blabbermouth. And you know why he is a blabbermouth? Your parents don't need to know. Your siblings or children may not deserve to know. Your friends may not deserve to know. But there's nobody closer than your alleged helpmate, and she deserves to know if she's one with you. That's what I observe. Okay? So, women would say, that's right. That's right. So, developing a monitored life, plus on top of all of those layers I just mentioned that really do work for me, they really help me. It's harder for me to escape somewhere. But here's one more reason. I live a public life. There's not a week that goes by that people don't recognize me somewhere, anywhere, everywhere on earth. I'm not famous like a movie star, but I have enough notoriety that no matter where I go, people will know me, and those are just the ones who say so. How many others watch and don't bother to say? And so, you know, I got off the plane in New York City and I walked down to the curb. I'm going to meet some friends and take a walk in the park, and a car screeches to a halt. In the city of 20 million people, they roll down their window and point at me. Are you Cy Rogers? Of course, moments like this, you are so thankful you are not like picking your nose or something. And I said, it's me. And they said, we watched you at Calvary Chapel in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, 1,000 miles south 2 years ago. Neat to see you. Now, only God can arrange the math like that. God will let you know you're in the right place at the right time. Isn't that amazing? How about, I've got to give you a couple other illustrations to get you oxygenated with laughter, because you're about to blank out on me here as your blood sugar level drops. So, for example, one time I was in Jakarta doing this seminar at the Hilton Hotel, and I was doing a sexual redemption seminar, and because it was on the weekend, the work day obviously had not opened up for Monday yet, and so this German banker was there waiting for the work week, but he was a Christian, and so he thought, well, since I'm here already on the weekend, I'll come along to this seminar. He didn't know it was about sexual themes. He got much more than he bargained for. And but the point is, I got to talking with him, and I said, you know, your accent doesn't sound very, very German. And he says, no, I'm actually from Brazil. I said, really? How cool. I'm on my way to Brazil, and I was a student there years ago, and I did some crippled Portuguese with him. And I said, I'm off to Brazil. And he says, well, where are you going? Are you going to Rio or Sao Paulo? And I said, yeah, but I'm also going to some of the smaller capital cities like Curitiba. He said, really? I'm from Curitiba. I said, really? Well, maybe you know the name of the Christian therapist who's bringing me in to lecture. His name is Dr. Carlos Grzybrowski. And he says, know him? He's married to my sister. Wait a minute. One more. I was in Dresden, Germany, and I was performing in this big, huge, warehoused nightclub. And the band that I was with, we were doing our thing, and out there were all these writhing, thronging young people sweating and dancing to the beat out there. And among them was this ancient, white-haired woman walking around. And I thought, well, good on you, Granny. Rock on. Never give up, you know? And so there she was, and I was like, what is this? So anyway, I lost her in the crowd and didn't see her further. Well, then, the next day, the band and I, we were up having our morning coffee at 1 in the afternoon, as you do, and waiting for the swelling to go down. And there we were having our coffee, and in walks this ancient woman. And I thought, wow, and she starts speaking good English at us. With a Teutonic accent, and she's speaking with us, and she says, you all clean up pretty good. And I said, yeah, you wouldn't know that I'm actually a pastor. She says, really? Well, my son is a pastor. I said, here in Dresden? She said, no, in Orlando, Florida, where I live. And I said, well, wow, and because my ministry is a little unusual in that I deal with sexual themes, maybe he would remember my ministry. It was pretty high profile in the U.S. in its day, and maybe he would know about it. And she says, well, do you know the work of Exodus? And I said, well, yeah, I used to be president. And suddenly we recognize each other. 12 years earlier, 5 hours north of San Francisco on the California coast, was a Christian retreat center that, as a multimillionaire, she owned. And there she cooked me and my board breakfast. And then 12 years later, she's in Dresden, and we run into each other. And we run into each other because she has since moved away from America, gone back to Germany, and she is now helping child prostitutes escape the streets, and thus she brought them to the club to hear the band, to hear the gospel. That's why she was there. Only God can order your steps like that. And so I mention this to you to let you know that there are always people watching. And I've had people follow me, and say, I watched you for the last hour with your kid. I just wanted to see if you were for real. You never know when people are watching, and it reminds me that God is always watching, the ultimate in accountability. It often we turn off, so he sometimes encourages us with flesh and blood reminders that he sees us everywhere we go. We cannot escape his vigilance. Would you agree? That's right. So, knowing when I'm most likely to compromise, that helps me. At least I can know when I'm losing altitude and begin to deal. Add to that, for example, having a monitored life. And you know, I don't find accountability to be oppressive. I find it to be such a relief that I can go to my people and I can, you know, submit myself and I can tell the dirt about myself so that today's little humility doesn't become tomorrow's great big humiliation. Okay? And then, thirdly, don't get distracted and caught up. I think that King David got distracted and didn't see it come upon him. And suddenly he was in the trap. Let me tell you a story about a plane crash. Yet another. I'm sorry. So, this aircraft, once again, a technologically advanced L-1011, the superior aircraft in its day, and this jumbo jet was flying on a simple two-hour flight from cold New York City in the Northern Hemisphere winter down to sunny Miami at Christmas time. And the sky was clear and starry at night. The flight attendants had Santa hats on, and the airplane was decorated, and people were feeling pretty festive. As the holidays approached, people were looking forward to getting with family and all of this. And so the plane had an uneventful, beautiful evening flight and was in its landing sequence when suddenly, as they put down the landing gear, a little light bulb went off on the pilot's cabin dashboard that said, "Your nose wheel isn't locked into place." Now, pilots have to ask the question, is this really a nose wheel issue? Or is this just a little short in a 10-cent light bulb giving us a fit? And so they radioed the tower and said, you know what? We're going to have to fly around one more time because we've got this little issue to resolve. And the tower said, no worries. You know, there's no other planes in the sky and you got a lot of room and the lights are bright below. Why don't you give the people a tour, bank around again and approach again and maybe you'll get it fixed. So cool. Everything was nice and easy. So the pilot getting ready to retire, after, I think, a 22 or 27-year career, the co-pilot, another professional, and the flight engineer, yet another professional in the pilot's cabin, all got fixated on resolving the light bulb versus the wheel issue. But all the while they were distracted, the plane was gradually losing altitude, and they drove that baby right into the dirt and crashed and burned because professionals who knew better got distracted. Goes to show you. Now, you can be relieved to know that that's why aircraft cabins today have a little device that if the humans don't read the ground, the computer will. And it will release an alarm that says, terrain, pull up. Just in case they're not tuned in, they've got that device installed in cabins now to help them pay attention. And I think that's just like the Holy Spirit living in us. We don't always realize when we're losing altitude. And that's why we need accountability and others through whom the Spirit can speak to say, how much time are you spending with the Lord? And what is your family life like? And what is going on? You know, where you look kind of tired. How's it going? You're going to get a break? I'm a little concerned. That's that losing altitude. Pull up. Don't get distracted and think you're not losing altitude. If I'm concerned enough to say something, how much more worthy of concern might that be? Because I'm scared to tell you and I'm being polite when I do. How much worse might it really be? Are you with me? So while people aren't going around having a mission of telling us what to do, if people really do love us, they'll be more than just polite. Real love is willing to intervene and say, I'm concerned. Tell me I'm wrong and prove it to me. Rebuke me if you must. I love you too much to politely ignore concerns that I see. True? Wouldn't you want someone saying that to you? And so don't get distracted. And then finally, fourthly, have that emergency exit in mind. You know the emergency exit routine? Fact of the matter is, what is that for us as believers? Flee from immorality. Just flee. Don't ponder. Don't reflect and meditate and consider. Just get out. Friend of mine was just about to get in bed and throw his ministry down the drain. He was about to commit sexual sin with somebody, and finally he heard the voice of the Holy Spirit telling him to get up and get out, and he walked out that door and never saw that person again and didn't bother to explain. He just fled. Yes, he had to report to his board. Yes, he needed discipline and maintenance. And yes, he got it mopped up, but better that he did it before a crash and burn than after. He walked away. That was his emergency exit. Get out. Flee. Doesn't the Bible tell us this? So you know the drill. In the event that we lose cabin pressure, the panel above your seat will open, revealing an oxygen mask. In this event, place the orange cup over your nose and mouth and continue to breathe normally. The plastic bag may not inflate fully, but oxygen will be flowing. Parents traveling with small children should don their own mask first before assisting those around them. A uniformed attendant will tell you when it's safe to remove the mask. Also, you'll notice throughout the cabin, there are emergency exits clearly indicated. Two forward, two over the wing, and two at the rear of the cabin. Take the time to acquaint yourself with the exit nearest you, remembering that your nearest exit may be behind you. Now, the reason why thank you so much. I told you, cabin crew from the beginning. So anyway, but the fact of the matter is, you know why I know this? Because not only do I hear it enough, I have to fly for a living. And therefore, I can't kind of hope it never happens to me. Because even though statistically, I can fly from New York to LA or Sydney to Perth for, well, every day for 2,600 years, statistically, before I would ever be in an emergency. But you know what? I've already been through a couple, and statistics don't give you much comfort when people are screaming and thinking they're going to die. And it's a little too late to go looking in the seat pocket for the information card. And so the point is, what does it say in Proverbs? The wise man understands that inevitably the day of trouble will arrive, and so he has already made a preparation for it. When the simpleton lives in denial, hopes it never happens, and suffers when it does. And so for me, if I'm on a plane, I want to do everything in my power to get home to my family. I can't control whether I live or die. I can control the airline that I fly with, and I can choose the aircraft I allow my body to fly on. But other than that, the rest is in God's affair, except I can also know how to operate the emergency exit, because research of crash survivors has shown this, that 90% of them who walk away, they got out in the first 30 seconds, and they had already figured out in their mind before the plane ever took off how the emergency exits on every aircraft function, so that if they had to do it blindly, they could make it work. And so this is how I go to work. And so I can't hope it never happens. I have to be prepared just in case. Similarly, you know, I have to realize that I'm a human being with my limitations and my vulnerabilities. And in spite of my very best strategies we've discussed, I have to remember the last emergency exit strategy of all, just get out. Just flee. Because trouble will inevitably arrive. I will be tempted. And so will you. And opportunities will come your way. Satan will see to it. And so to think that it'll never happen and I hope it never does is naive. Take your first step toward disaster if you think that you're above and beyond this. And that's why it's important that we run through some of this drill so that we can know what to do just in case. Would you agree? That's why we talk about it. Now, before we have our delicious lunch break, what do you want? What's your questions? Did you find this useful? Now, what would you have as a question? Yeah.
What's the scripture, please?
And I'm sorry, what? Which part?
Just recently, you used a scripture on the Proverbs.
About?
Wise men, da 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 da.
The wise man sees the day of trouble approaching and makes preparation. I want to say it's 22, and there's another one on the heels of it, like 25. Or it could be 25 and 27. I'll have to do what the Apostle Paul said, and if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for me. Somewhere it's written. But it's in the mid-20s of the Proverbs, and it's twice. It's in two different Proverbs, that same concept. Somebody else have a question? I see my work here is done. When I'm traveling. Well, I'm unusual in this regard. I sometimes will travel with a team of people, yes. And if it's not my wife, however, I don't travel with just one other person, generally. Because, you know, if I hang out with a girl, people are suspect. But if I hang out with a guy, people are more suspect. So, I would say I'm kind of the exception to what might be most pastors' protocol. But you got to understand, too, because like a lot of the aircraft, like flying down under here, a lot of flight attendants will know who I am. I'm not going to misbehave. And also, I go through customs and immigration here in New Zealand. There are Christians who work right there and put the chop in my passport. They'll say, "Hi, Si, I hear you're going to be at..." And then, coming to a place like I've been, most of the places I travel on Earth, I've been going to over and over again, like New Zealand or like Australia, where my wife knows the people that I'm hanging out with. There are people in this very church that I used to live with in Singapore. There are people in this nation that I connect with or bump into that are a part of my life and have been for years, so that when I'm coming here without my family, I'm not like pining away all alone in some isolated hotel room, really, really lonely. I'm busy in my free time connecting with my mates and having a good time, so my emotional cup is filled up, and I am also held accountable by people. And so there is no perfect accountability. If you want to cheat, you can do it no matter who's traveling with you. But the fact of the matter is, I'm not, but God has built in kind of compensations otherwise to help me. But yes, it is true, sometimes I do travel with my wife, and sometimes I do travel with a friend or ministry colleague, but often it's in a team format, so that it's not just me and another person that others might view as suspicion. So yeah, I have to do it even a higher standard. But there are compensations that do help me. So I appreciate that. Mm-hmm.
Proverbs 22.
See, he was right. 22. 22 what?
22:3
and?
27:12.
Very good. On those scriptures. Yep. Thank you very much. Uh-huh.
Can you elaborate more on chapter 7? Like, do you see it as the one that has seven things, or is it more an overall attitude?
I think it's an overall attitude, because I don't think God intended us to get bent up on technicality. But I do think, nevertheless, there is wisdom in the idea of at least one day in the week. Because if you know about sleep deprivation, you never write off sleep. You will pay back to the sleep bank. So you can burn the candle for a couple of days. You can burn the candle for a couple of weeks, even a couple of months. But if you don't pay it back voluntarily, that's when your immune system begins to crash and you are required to take time out until your body says the bank is paid back. So a lot don't know this feature about sleep, and it's been more recently understood that it's like this in its physiologic effect, and there's why I think God gave us wisdom in saying, take a day off. And that doesn't mean to do everything else apart from the office. It means get sleep, revive your body, get rest, take care of your body, connect with ones you love, and fill up your fuel tank with God in case you didn't get to the rest of the time. So I really do try to make that routine. Sometimes the day has to shift. And with a life on the fly like mine is, sometimes I have to figure out, you know, like, oh, I see a window. I'm going to grab that now. And it really does help me. So it's both. But I'm not overly technical about it. Like, if I didn't do it this week, I'm, you know, it can go 9 days versus seven, or it could go 5 days instead of seven, that kind of a thing. I really do try to take an entire day off or more. I'm going to have a week, you know, like I said, off duty to sleep, because then I've got to get on a plane and go to Canada, and then I'm back down under in 3 weeks. So there you go. Appreciate you asking. Anybody else? I thought I saw one more hand. Well, we're getting ready to enjoy what is obviously going to be a luscious... No? Depends on where they go. It could be deprivation for you, or it could be a feast. But we are going to have some housekeeping about lunch, and when we reconvene, here we go.